Where was I?
Okay, we're back, and it's still June the 10th, and I believe Colonel Pope, we're talking about Vokes and your relationship to him as the intelligence officer.
Yes. No, I was on very good relationships with Brigadier Vokes, and it really stemmed from when we had moved from Brighton to Eastbourne, and we'd been there about 4 days when the Brigadier called me into his office and said, "Well, Pope, what do you think of my appreciation?" And I said, "What appreciation, sir?" And he said, "Good God, man, don't you know what's going on around here? You're the intelligence officer." And I said, "Sir, I didn't know you'd written an appreciation." He said, "Well, I have." And he called to the Brigadier and said, "Where's that appreciation?" And the Brigadier said, "Oh, yes, sir, I've got it." And the Brigadier, the Brigade Major, and the Brigadier said, "Why haven't you shown it to the intelligence officer?" And there was a bit of a mumble by the Brigade Major, and he produced it. Mm-hmm. So Chris Vokes made me sit down in his office then and there and read his appreciation. And when I'd finished, he said, "Well, what do you think of it?" And I said, "Well, sir, it's not bad. There are a couple of things that I don't think are right." And he said, "What?" And I said, "Well, sir, you infer in the appreciation that an enemy landing below Beachy Head would be almost impossible because they wouldn't be able to climb up Beachy Head from the seaside." And I said, "That's wrong, sir." Mm-hmm. "How do you know that?" And I said, "Well, some of our own fellows have already climbed up from the seaside, up Beachy Head and into the radar station at the top, where they were nabbed by the guard, but not until they were almost through the radar station." He said, "Good God, Pope, why don't you tell me these things?" And I said, "Well, sir, it only happened yesterday." And he said, "What else is wrong?" And I said, "Well, I think you're wrong on the tides coming along from Pevensey towards Beachy Head." I said, "Any landing there would be most unlikely because the sand shallows, they're always shifting, and nobody knows where these are at any one time, and the chances of a ship getting through or a landing craft to get through without grounding itself would be very, very chancy, and therefore it's most unlikely that Germans would make any landing in the Pevensey Bay area." Mm-hmm. He said, "Where did you get that information?" I said, "From the Coast Guard, sir." "Or where was that?" And I said, "Well, I made one of my first calls up to the Coast Guard station up on Beachy Head, where they had all the tides, so because I felt that this was going to be an important factor." Mm-hmm. And he said, "God damn it, man, don't go to the Coast Guard. Go and listen to the local fishermen. They're the ones that know, not the Coast Guard." Mm-hmm. I said, "All right, sir." So with that, I took off, but I didn't go and interview any local fishermen. I went back to the Coast Guard station and made sure that my memory wasn't playing me false. Rechecked the evidence of their tide charts, knew that I was right, and came back, reported into Brigadier Vokes, and he said, "Well, Pope, what did you find out about the tides?" And I said, "I was right, sir. You were wrong." Mm-hmm. He said, "God damn it," he said, that appreciation is word to word the same as the one that the British Brigadier in this area had done before we came in. What he'd done was to take the British Brigadier's paper, which was handed over, mm-hmm. and had it retyped and signed it himself, and hadn't really checked into anything, mm-hmm. and was horrified to find that this had gone wrong. And because of that, he felt that he could trust me not to ever give him anything but the facts. Mm-hmm. And the whole time he was a brigadier, which was right up into Sicily, into Italy, he kept me as his intelligence officer.
Did you become close with him at all, or was it
No, purely in business. Because he and I were totally different in nature. Mm-hmm. As I said earlier on, he had a tendency to be a bit of a bully. And I never cared for bullies. Mm-hmm. But he was my brigadier, he had my loyalty, and I worked very well with him. Mm-hmm. And I worked very well with everybody, but I wasn't palsy-walsy with too many people. I was a bit of a lone wolf all my life.
You mentioned that you stayed with him for an awfully long time. Did you resent this? Did you want to get back out of the company?
I wanted to get back to the regiment. I didn't mind being there. I was there for, it seemed like a long time. But I wanted to get back to the regiment, and I applied, two or three times to go back, particularly when I felt that he was getting a little bit impossible at times. And all he did was, don't be a damn fool, you stay with me, and he tore out my application, and that was it.
And what rank were you at this point?
I was a captain.
Full captain? Or
full captain. I was acting captain, and then I've forgotten. I'd have to look at my record to find out when I became a full captain. I became a full captain in June 43, and that was in Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we headed for Sicily.
And you were still the brigade?
Intelligence officer. While we were in Eastbourne,
so this is early 42 again, or
this is, I guess, let me have a look at that sheet again on my record. You see, I didn't leave, wait a minute, I left the Seaforth in April 42 to be the IO 2nd Brigade Headquarters, which they show here is May 42. So I was IO May 42 as an acting captain. So I would say that this was really and truly the summer of 1942 that I'm talking about at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Dieppe occurred.
And I wanted to ask you about that.
And being on the coast,
mm-hmm.
We actually were not aware of Dieppe until after it happened.
Hear anything across the channel, the actual battle thing?
We noticed there was a little sort of disturbance,
mm-hmm.
and the Coast Guard said there's something going on there, but nobody knew just what.
Yeah.
And, but it was interesting that I was receiving through intelligence channels down to my level information of the German troops that were across the channel right opposite the Eastbourne Pevensey area. And I knew the name of the officer commanding the German troops.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what time he got up in the morning, what time he usually went to bed. I knew what girlfriends he was favoriting, was having favors from. I knew the name of the unit, the number of the unit, you know, the name, you could say,
mm-hmm.
of the German units, the expected or rated caliber of the troops, as to whether they were just coastal troops or whether they were fighting infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And also we had good information on the reserves in behind that might be brought forward if something happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me, you're on the coast presumably to defend it. What would be the need for you personally as an IO for that brigade to have the information of your opposite on the other coast, because surely if the Germans were going to invade, it wouldn't be he that would and his unit that would be invading. They're coastal defense units in the same sense that you are. Why was it so important for you to have that information?
Looking back on it, I don't really know, except that was extremely useful,
mm-hmm.
in that it kept our interest up when we were well into our third year of so-called phony war. And anything that can keep the interest up. For instance, at about that time, we got movies taken of the German paratroops landing in Crete. And this was put down to all brigades in the Canadian division. And the intelligence officers of the brigades took them around to every unit and showed them to a company at a time. And the whole thing was to impress on the men that if they were going to come in to fight the Germans, one thing you better be is physically fit.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you could see from these films of the German paratroopers landing in Crete and the way they moved once they landed,
mm-hmm.
They were fit men.
They were the elite, weren't they?
I know. So were we.
That's who you thought.
We were damn sure we were.
Yeah.
And we had to be elite too. Mm-hmm. And it did do a tremendous boosting job to our fellows to realize, all right, if we are going to meet those SOBs, then we have got to be right on our best physical fitness and really know how to operate. Because there's no fooling. You could tell that when you looked at the film. They were really fantastic films.
High professional. And that creep especially, because yeah. it was amphibious, it was airdrops.
That's right.
Beautifully coordinated.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, how any of our fellows ever got off that island back to Egypt, I don't know how the Navy managed it, but they did. But it was a very impressive film, and it came along just at the time when Monty was driving home his business of going for runs before breakfast, and you'd see the companies out running on the road, country roads of England down the south there. And even Brigadier Vokes used to go out every morning, much against his will, and run with the troops. And none of us enjoyed it, but we realized that that it was all for our good. And in those days, you did things like that. You didn't say, I'm going to stand on my rights. I'm not going to run. Because if you said that, Brigadier says, fine, back you go. And nobody at that time, amongst the group that were there, wanted to ever go back to Candor under that kind of a so-called cloud. And this business of standing on my rights was just a lot of stupid nonsense. You had to work as a member of a team. You had your own place, and if you weren't there, somebody else had to fill it, because everybody was needed to make the cogs turn properly and smoothly. You developed a teamwork. And one thing under Chris Vokes, you developed teamwork. And if you can't, then you are out. And you would get such a lousy report that nobody would employ you. And the whole thing was teamwork, teamwork. Not only in the brigade headquarters, but within the brigade, within the units. Everything had to go as a team, as a clock. And every man broke down, didn't fill his part properly, and then the teamwork didn't work.
Did any senior officers lose positions under Vokes because of this?
I would say any who through... you see, we went overseas with a number of officers who were in their mid-30s, early 40s, and frankly, under that training, they couldn't last. Much as they internally, as far as integrity was concerned, they were there, but they just couldn't quite hack it.
Was Stevenson an example of that?
Stevenson was one. But he had brought the battalion, and the battalion went through a bad period. We got some officers who were first-class gentlemen, but were not disciplinarians. And the men were getting away with murder in their excuses for not doing this and not doing that. And the thing is, if there's a job to be done, unless you fall dead, there's no excuse for not getting it done. Well, now, when I say falling dead, it could be that you fell so ill that you couldn't. But it meant that you were off to hospital. But to be alive and fit and not do the job required of you, there's no excuse.
That's satisfactory.
And to say, well, I didn't wake up, that's just too bad. You better train yourself to wake up. And if you can't, then you've got no place in this team. And it just came that simple. But some of these, we had a couple of officers, unfortunately, very nice fellows, but not disciplinarians. And the morale of the battalion went down.
Would this perhaps be a slur, not a slur, but perhaps from the days of the militia, the relationship the officers had with the men and the sort of cozy atmosphere of the militia?
It could be. But Bert Hoffmeister went to senior officer's school, and he came back from that and took over command of the battalion.
And yeah, what are we speaking of now?
And now we're talking of, I would think, round about November 42. And the battalion, the Z-Force, became a new entity. They became a unit which knew they had a commanding officer who could do anything that any man in the battalion could do.
They knew him, hadn't they?
Probably do it better. And they knew what he was like as a company commander, and they knew what he expected of them, and they knew what would happen if they didn't do it. And they knew that he wouldn't hold any punches. In fact, he was a fearsome rugger player, too, and he played rugger back in Vancouver. But he got the whole battalion morale back up again, and they were a fighting unit again. just shows the difference between a fellow who is a good leader and also a good disciplinarian. And he just made all the difference to that regiment. Mm-hmm. It was just terrific.
And you were chafing at the bit to get back to them, weren't you?
Yes, I would have liked to, because with him as the battalion commander, I'd served under him when he was a company commander.
And you two had gone on well?
And got on very well. And then came, I guess it was the starting of combined operations training in Scotland, up at Inverary. And that was interesting. We went up there a brigade at a time, 1st Brigade, 2nd Brigade, 3rd Brigade. We all took our turns. We all had our fill of fog and damp and cold and miserable, skinning down the sides of ships and so forth.
Even you as an IO?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Where would you be now? The companies... You would be with the headquarters company? Or?
No, I was with the brigade headquarters.
Okay, but you would still be going down the sides of ships?
Well, when it was time for the brigade headquarters to land, as per landing schedule, you had to get down into the boat and chug-chug into shore, and you hoped that this newfangled radio business was going to work properly, and that you'd be able to keep in touch with your battalions that are up there in the heather somewhere. A very interesting little incident occurred while we were in Inverary. The officer commanding the Seaforth Highlanders of Canada, Colonel Bertram Hoffmeister, good Scottish name, who knew more about Highland music and Highland dancing than most Highlanders, he'd been a Seaforth cadet, amongst other things, went to see the Duke of Argyll to ask him for his permission for the Canadian Seaforth pipe band to play retreat in the village square of Inverary. And the Duke of Argyll listened to his request and then said, "What tartan do you wear?" And we said, well, he said, "The Mackenzie tartan, sir." He said, "In that case, you'll not be playing. If you go into the courtyard," I was going to say, "of the local kirk, where all the graves are, you'd be horrified to see graves on which were inscribed on the gravestones the names of father, mother, children, who were all killed by MacDonalds, Mackenzies, Gordons, who came down over the mountains in the wintertime, surrounded the kirk on a Sunday, and they killed every man, woman, and child in retaliation for Culloden," or Culloden, as some people call it. And not Culloden, the big MacDonald massacre by the Campbells.
Glencoe?
Glencoe, that's the thing, not Culloden, Glencoe.
And Culloden was the Bonnie Prince Charlie.
That's right. It's Glencoe. And this was a retaliation for the massacre in Glencoe. And here was the proof of it right there. And we wore the Mackenzie tartan.
Yeah.
And we were not allowed to play. The 48th Highlanders from Toronto, they wanted to do the same thing. And they were turned down. They wore the Gordon tartan. They still do. But the Duke of Argyll said no. Of course, he's a Campbell. Anyway, Bert Hoffmeister was not a man to be turned down without going back and trying again. So he went back and explained that in our own pipe band we had three Campbells, and that in Canada this clan feud was long time forgotten. So the Duke reluctantly granted us permission, which he never granted to the 48th Highlanders.
But you were still wearing the Mackenzie
tartan? Still wearing the Mackenzie tartan. So our pipe band, with Pike Major Essen at its head, they dressed themselves in their finest, horsehair sporrans, white spats, everything. Went down to the village square, and not a single local person came out to watch us. One drunk staggered out from the pub at the time, took one look, and went back in. All the windows of the pubs and the houses surrounding the square were all boarded up. Mm-hmm. We were told it was in case there was a German bombing. But not one local person came out. Mm-hmm. They didn't mind selling us cloth for kilts or for to take home for our wives to make skirts out of. Mm-hmm. But they would not be coming out to listen to our pipe band. No way.
Did you play anyway?
Oh yes, we played for 4 nights. Retreat. Mm-hmm. And not a single local person came out in all that time. So people who say that feuds don't last, I'm not talking about Scotland when they say that.
No, not Scotland or Ireland. Or
and I was brought up as a wee boy when I was in Scotland to never trust a camel.
Yeah.
And a very dirty trick was done on me and my wife on the day we got married. Mm-hmm. And it was done by a camel.
What was it?
I still don't trust camels, and I'm not telling you.
Yeah. Okay, I'll ask you if the tape's over. Okay, now where the heck were we? Ah, yes, we were doing combined ops training. That's right.
Well, we eventually got back to our own areas. Mm-hmm. From combined ops training. And we still went on exercises.
Before we get that, the combined ops training, on what sort of scale was it? Was it all the whole brigade doing it at once?
Yeah.
So was that
well, it started out with just a battalion doing its own. And then the final exercise was the whole brigade.
Did you have any mishaps? Because I know the DX preparation.
Oh, we had
screwed up in some of the
we had some mix up. We found that we were not landed on the beach we thought we were going to be landed on. And then when you get up into the bogs of the hills around Inverary, and you knew it was only an exercise, and we'd been doing exercises for a long, long time, and the fellows were getting wet and cold and miserable, you felt very much like saying, "What the hell with it?" But you also realized subconsciously that this is really for our benefit, because it was going to come. And we better know how to get into a boat. We better hope that our midshipmen who were steering these boats, that they got better too, putting us on the proper beach. Mm-hmm. And so that the training altogether was good, and also it was good training to be in foggy, damp, wet conditions, because if you only train under the best conditions, you're not going to stand up too well when they get nasty.
Okay, let's pass over combined ops.
So we moved back, and I'm skipping an awful lot.
Oh, that's okay.
But we went back, and then some of us were told the brigadier had to go, the brigade major would take over and take charge of the brigade. But from each brigade went the brigadier, his intelligence officer, and I think it was the DAQMG, the captain supply, and a captain from the ops side. The brigade major stayed behind. The commanding officer of each battalion with his intelligence officer and one company commander came up, and we were formed into, I'm not sure about the battalions, golly, I can't remember. I think the battalion commanders came up later on. But to start with, we went up and we became the planning center for our brigade within the divisional plan that was being developed for landing in Sicily. Mm-hmm. And
you knew at this time that
we who went up there to a place called Norfolk House in London.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also where the combined ops planning was done.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans had a planning crew in there from North Africa, and we all had to be given passes and so forth. Otherwise, you couldn't get in, and we were not to tell anybody. It was top secret. The units had no idea. Some of them were conjecturing, of course, that we were going places other than Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Norway was still being booted around. And we worked there on the planning staff, and I, as the brigade intelligence officer, had total responsibility for getting to know complete plans for every battalion in the brigade.
Mm-hmm.
Also for the support, as so far as the artillery, 3rd Field Regiment, and the engineers that were going to be supporting us when they'd be landing, I had to know everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very interesting period. My wife was getting ready to go into hospital to have our first child, and she, strange to say, was going to 15th Canadian General in Bramshott, where I had been with my volvulus of the sigmoid colon. And I used to see her, but of course couldn't say a word to her. And then came the time when we gathered in Hamilton, outside Glasgow. And we were there when my brigadier, Vokes, got notice that I had a son. He called me into his office, congratulated me, told the staff captain to book a place on the overnight train down to London. I had a 36-hour pass. I went to the hospital, saw my wife and boy. He looked like a wrinkled old prune.
Did you name him then?
Yes, we agreed on the name then.
And what was that?
Michael Norman. Mm-hmm. And I went back up, and I couldn't tell my wife where I was going or anything. And I didn't see her until August of next year.
Really? After you'd been off through Italy?
All through Sicily and up Italy, as far as, almost as far as Rome. Mm-hmm. And we did one exercise off the Solway, which, strange to say, in silhouette and in the approaches from the water, were almost identical to what we were going to find when we got to Sicily.
Mm-hmm. And did you put two and two together?
No. Well, I knew where we were going, but the men in the unit still didn't know. And it wasn't until we were well on the way to Gibraltar that the news was broken to everybody. I happened to be on the Circassia, which was the brigade headquarters ship. Mm-hmm. We had the Seaforth on board and some engineer units and some others who I can't remember. But as the intelligence officer, I was assigned a room down in the bowels of the ship, and I had to put up my model of Sicily, of that section that we were going to be landing in, and I had to prepare it, and throughout the voyage to Sicily, while the fellows upstairs were sunning themselves on the decks, I was down in the bowels of the ship, taking in officers and men, a group at a time, and saying, this is where you'd be landing. And there were photographs there taken from aeroplanes flying in, so you got a landing view of the coastline that you're coming into, and you know, this is where you're going to be landing, and this is where your first objective is, and that's your second objective, these people will be on your left flank, and on the right you'll have so and so. And I was doing this the whole day, every day, because it took all that time with everybody on board. Mm-hmm. And they all arrived ready to land in Sicily, and they were all suntanned, and I was still as white could be. However, so was my intelligence sergeant and my intelligence boys, because they were down there too. But it was fresh painted, and if you've ever been down in the bowels of a ship, in a room with fresh paint, and only the forced air that the ship air conditioning system was forcing through, and you get into any kind of a rolling weather, it's not a good place to be. You can generate headaches, you can generate all sorts of other things, and I found that many of the fellows that came in to be briefed on the model, that they lasted about 20 minutes and that was it. They had to get up and get fresh air. However, we managed it, and I finally got up for fresh air on the night before we were due to land.
I was finished.
I had no more duties. I had done all I could do as far as briefing them was concerned. And my time was my own now. Admittedly, I got up and I've forgotten even how I slept there. I have a feeling I almost slept down there. Anyway, got up on ship and rough. Boy, that night before we landed, it was rough. And we swung north and headed for our landing zone. And I've forgotten the name of the captain of the Circassia.
What kind of ship was the Circassia? Was it a liner?
A passenger ship, liner. And I'm sure very comfortable in its day, but it wasn't that wonderful for us. But when first light broke, we were already heading into landing, and there was still quite a sea running. But it gradually calmed down. By the time brigade headquarters headed for shore, the eddies and the... I've forgotten right now even who the two lead battalions in our brigade. And we'd heard things weren't quite right, but it was a bit of a muddle, but not too much. But anyway, we headed and we grounded on the beach, and down went the ramp of the landing craft, and there was dear old Chris Volk saying, "Follow me, men." There were already two battalions ahead of us, and at least two, if not three. And I couldn't help laughing a bit, but he had loaded me with everything he didn't want to carry. I had his map, I had his binoculars, I had my own stuff. I was carrying a big map board on which I was hoping to keep record of where units had got to as the reports came in. And when I stepped off the ramp, we stepped off into about 3.5 feet of water. And my knees buckled because the sand gave way underneath me, and I went face flat forward into the water with all these... I was like a ruddy Christmas tree. Anyway, it was a beautiful, sunny day, stinking hot. And we got ashore, and there was sand galore, and we didn't have any vehicles at the time.
The ship was in a slow convoy that left early and sunk.
Well,
I read something about
yeah,
that.
But that was mostly... other vehicles, not the brigade headquarter vehicles, like our jeeps. And we started to get ourselves together, and we did, a jeep did come along pretty soon for the brigadier, and he popped me into it with him, because I was a key person for his information. And we made darn good progress. The battalions that were there ahead of us, they really... did extremely well when you think it was all foot power.
Did the Italians get too much, make too much resistance?
None whatsoever. It was pitiful, really.
Lost prisoners?
Well, they just gave themselves up.
Yeah.
We heard stories about the commanders who'd landed on our left, where the Italians had some guns sighted there.
Mm-hmm.
And they apparently surprised the Italian completely, and in the usual commander way, dead enemy is much the best, won't give you any trouble, and we don't have to bother with prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
So they killed every single one of them, which suddenly made some of our boys suddenly realize, by golly, we are in a war after all.
Yeah.
And it was a useful story to hear, and I believe there was some truth to it, but I can't say how much. Anyway, it was a stinking hot, and I remember clearly we got into a field of melons, and I remember cutting a melon right in half and just slapping it right over my face, pips and all, and it was just wonderful. Just wonderful. I never liked melons so much. They were just beautiful melons. And one thing that struck me about Sicily, in some respects it was almost like a Garden of Eden. Talk about fruit. Of course, we hadn't seen fruit like that since 39. And to see all this fruit there, it was just unreal. But it wasn't long before we got into contact with the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And then things became slightly different as the fighting. There weren't people giving themselves up.
Okay, now you're the intelligence officer. How was the information transmitted to you? Were you plugged into radios or messengers? How were people coming to you?
We were getting information from the battalions as to where they were, and also the battalion intelligence officers were sending back info, because they'd had some training in recognition of units and by epaulettes, etc.
So did you have control over the different IOs of the different battalions?
Yes.
So they actually worked for you as much as they worked for them?
Oh yes, it's part of the intelligence TOEFL system.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept me informed, and I kept the division people informed, and each divisional IO kept them, the divisional headquarters informed. And they kept the British Corps informed. And also, we did capture some prisoners, and there is one photograph of me interviewing, if you can use the word, German prisoners in Sicily. And I've forgotten it. It's quite a well-known photograph. And Sicily was a real experience. I think I averaged about 2 hours snooze in every 24 for the month that we were fighting. And I would say this applied to nearly everybody. And he was a tough slug. And fellows were going down with diarrhea. But Hoffmeister got it. And he was an tireless commanding officer, generally up with the leading company, where no self-respecting battalion commander should be. but he wasn't a self-respecting. He said, wherever the fighting is best, that's where I'll be. And left his battalion headquarters staff to keep track of where he was. And the company commanders knew they had to get on and do a good job because he's going to be stepping on their heels. And
did you like your work at this point?
Oh, I found it really challenging, keeping track of where the men were, where the units were, and to keep my map marked up, because amongst other things, I also had to speak to war correspondents who were a bit of a pest, particularly a fellow called Ross Monroe.
Oh, yes, gauntlet overload.
Well, Ross Monroe happened to come up to 2nd Brigade headquarters near a town called Grand Michele in Sicily. And I had my map up. We'd had a little bit of a tough time at Grand Michele. And he asked me what the situation was, and I told him I didn't have too much time. I was busy as could be. The brigadier wasn't there. And Ross Monroe said, well, thanks a lot, Norm. And I said, that's okay. And later, I found he'd reported on this conversation with me, had named me, and apparently had found out that I had been active with the Vancouver Little Theater, so he included that in my column on me, and a few other things about Rugger with the Vancouver Rowing Club. And he quoted me as saying things about the battle which I had never said to him. And the next time I saw him, I said, never again will I be interviewed by you. He said, why, what's wrong? I said, well, I've just found out the article that you wrote. And I said, you quoted me as saying this, that, and the other, which I never said. He said, well, didn't you like it? I gave you a little bit of publicity. And I said, look, I don't need publicity, and I don't want it. And he said, oh, well, he said, it won't hurt you. And but what I didn't like was the fact that he was reporting things that weren't true.
Yeah.
And that put me off all newspaper correspondence.
Have you read his books at all?
Yes.
What do you think of them?
Well,
they're rather sensational.
Yeah, I'm afraid I have my tongue in my cheek.
Yeah.
On many of them. And of course, there was one war correspondent named Peter. Oh. Names.
American, British?
No, Canadian. Oh, that's awful. I'll get it later on. Well, I was at school with him in England as it happened. And he seldom dropped beyond Corps headquarters, but he gave faithful reports about how everything was going, which I guess is as good as you could expect. Corps headquarters is probably a better perspective than if he'd been right up front. But one of the best, if not the best, war correspondent from my point of view was a fellow called Matthew Halton, father of the present Halton, who you see on CBC. He was terrific.
Brian Halton,
Is it Brian? His father was Matthew Halton. Matt Halton, and he was fantastic. He'd be up with the leading company of the leading battalion, and he knew of what he was talking and what he wrote, and he was really good. And I think every man that came across him liked him. To me, he was the tops. He was my idea of what a war correspondent should be, not sitting at Corps headquarters waiting for info to be handed out.
He was very seeing it firsthand.
He was getting it firsthand. But maybe he was giving a different picture. He wasn't giving the overall big picture. He was giving the little picture.
talking about Sicily and your role. How was your voice, by the way? Feeling okay?
Just about finished.
Okay. Well, let's end up on Sicily then. I think that the Seaforth ended up about the early part of, or middle of August.
It must have been about the beginning of August.
Uh-huh.
And
the whole brigade at that point?
The whole division went into reserve to get ready for Italy. Each battalion was given its own little area.
Mm-hmm.
Brigade headquarters was given its own little area. The area the Seaforth got was known properly as Happy Valley. It was probably the nicest spot around that part of Sicily.
Mm-hmm. Was it on the water?
Lovely, no. It was in a valley. Nice lot of green trees, lots of beautiful fruit, water flowing through there, and just close enough to the sea that you could be bundled into a truck and trucked down to the beaches, beautiful white beaches, and beautiful warm water, clear water.
Oh,
and it was really a really good picture.
Book, No Birds Sang?
No, I haven't read it, but I have met Farley.
He was
one
in Happy
night.
Valley, wasn't he? I remember that, and I think he was there.
Maybe the Hasty Peas were there. I don't know. They were 1st Brigade. 2nd Brigade, I know the Seaforths were in Happy Valley. And Brigade Headquarters was put on a knoll. We weren't in any Happy Valley, but we used to visit the Seaforths in their Happy Valley. And, of course, during that period, there were some incidents. Chris Vokes was not the best liked of brigadiers. There were a few men who didn't like him. And the Sicilians have a lovely, deep-colored rose wine, which is sheer murder if you drink too much of it. And one particular fellow had drunk enough of it that he was going to get Chris Vokes. Well, in being in a foreign country, Chris Vokes still had a sentry on duty outside his casa, where he was sleeping, living. And this fellow, really, he didn't know where he was, except he knew where the brigadier should be.
Did no one try to stop him at all?
One, coming to that, this fellow was frothing purple at the mouth.
Yeah.
And the sentry came down to the on-guard position, and sort of, you can't go any further, and this fellow walked right onto his bayonet and then collapsed. The fellow didn't move his bayonet, he just walked onto it, right into his stomach. And they dashed him off to hospital right away. And I guess God looks after drunks, because that bayonet went into his stomach and didn't pierce a single piece of intestine. And he came out of that perfectly all right. But that was just one little incident.
You'd think that if the bayonet had, that the alcohol would have purified it anyway.
Well, that could have been it. But he survived and went on. He never left his unit.
Mm-hmm. He wasn't charged with anything?
No.
Not even grunting it?
No. Heck, if you'd done that, you'd have charged everybody. But I was so tired after that month of fighting in Sicily that as soon as my safari bed came up with the stuff. It was unrolled, put together, and I lay on it and just passed out. And I was told afterwards that my batman faithfully moved me around the tree under which I had gone to sleep on my safari bed, so that I kept in the shade all the time the sun was moving. And I slept like that for just over 48 hours. I didn't know. I didn't eat anything, drink anything. I just fell asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Because being the brigade IO, I found that my brigadier used to say, "Pope, I'm going to have a snooze. You stay awake." "Yes, sir." And then when he woke up, it was, "Pope, let's go."
It was never invoked, "I'm going to have a sleep."
No, never, never. There was one in that Sicilian campaign, there was one a little incident where Chris Vokes was in two minds whether to fire me. We'd received a map reference from Div headquarters to go to an O group. took it down, and I had it repeated to make sure I had the figures correct. Worked it out on the map, and I said, I know where to go. And the brigadier said, let's go. Hopped in the back of the jeep, and away we went. And we got up this road, drove a little further, and I said, sir, things are getting awfully quiet around here. There was a beautiful sort of hush. You couldn't hear any birds. You couldn't hear anything. There was that horrible silence. You felt somehow that you had no business to be there. And then we happened to look on either side of us, and there were men in slit trenches. And folks said to me, you sure you got that map reference correct? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, correct or not, we're not going any further. I said, good, sir. So we about turned, and we pushed out from there, and we ran into somebody else who was coming up the road, and it was supposed to be going to the old group, and we said, not that way, and somehow or other we found out where the old group was, and apparently the divisional intelligence officer had put up the wrong map reference, so we were exonerated, but it was a little hairy there for a time.
Yes, I think so. You were heading to the front, and you were
actually we were in the front. We didn't like being in the front.
I'd rather be in Happy Valley.
And there were several other incidents, but I can't recall the details. I just remember the name of that newspaper correspondent. I couldn't think of Peter Sturzberg.
I've heard of that as well.
Oh, yeah. He became quite a famous man later on for other things.
For television?
Yes, for television. He used to be the CBC man down at the United Nations. Oh, he was a Victoria boy, born in Shanghai. Well, I think that's about enough for today, don't you?
Yeah, we've got through Sicily, and next time, whatever that might be, we'll tackle, I suppose, your transfer, or you're moving back to the Seaforth, and...
Well, we go across into the toe of Italy,
and
up through the toe of Italy, and up to Campobasso, and I was still intelligence officer. That's where some prisoners of war started coming through from fellows who'd been captured at Tobruk, South Africans, so forth. And I befriended one of them. He stayed with us just south of Campobasso for a couple of days. He got himself fattened up a bit. And then he went off down the line.